Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Real Air Podcast. I'm Ian Parkinson and our guests on this edition is the broadcaster, commentator and now star not only of screen but stage as well, Ned Bolting. No, it's you I'm talking about.
Hello, Ian.
Welcome back. And the Real Air editor, Ian Cleverley. Last time we met for the podcast, Ned, we were in Ealing Studios. Home of St Trinian's. This time last year, with Dave Miller. The time before that, of course, we were here. I should explain where we are. We're at Herne Hill Velodrome in South London, but we were in the middle of the field over there because at the time the building work on this extraordinary new pavilion had not even started. It's a pretty amazing transformation, isn't it?
No, it's just a great... I mean, I've been coming down here for 2 or 3 years as an active participant, and I've almost forgotten what it was like when there was nothing here. And, you used to have to kind of fumble around in the porta cams out the back to find a toilet, and, you know, and the tap was over there and all that, and there's no... It's just great. There's even a rumour that the coffee machine might be up and active in a second.
It sounds like the coffee machine is brewing up.
For anyone who's not been down here, even if you don't come down to Ride, just come and have a look if you're passing by. It's great.
Yeah, there was a race here on Sunday, Brixton CC Madison race, and it was extraordinary because it was a beautiful sunny day. People sitting out on the steps, having the jerk chicken, drinking a beer. It was just an extraordinary transformation. You were here as well, weren't you?
Indeed, it was the ultimate Brixton CC meeting. You know, had all the vibes going. Plus, you could actually, I mean, and it was blisteringly hot as well. So yeah. It really came into its own. This place, you know, sitting on the steps in the shade.
So, away from the Velodrome, Tour de France is coming up.
Yeah, this time next week. Well, we're pre-recording this, obviously, so I don't know when you're going to be listening to this podcast, but very imminently I'm heading for Düsseldorf in Nordrhein-Westfalen. And the first time the tour started there since, when was it? 80? Should know this, shouldn't I? Should trip off the tongue. What I do remember reading about, and it just makes me laugh every time I think about it, was that for 1 minute, that Tour de France was led on paper. The virtual maillot jaune was Shane Sutton. He was the first man off the start ramp in the opening time trial. And, of course, he posted the best time. And it lasted less than a minute, actually.
Whatever happened to him?
Where's he now,
How many tours is this?
This will be number 15.
Still enjoying it?
Yeah, loving it. Probably more than ever. I was, perhaps like we all do, if you've been in a job for quite a while, I think possibly with hindsight, I was getting a little bit stale in what I was doing, you know, simply presenting and reporting, talking to riders at the start and finish and doing other bits and pieces. And switching to commentating has kind of reinvigorated my obsession with this race in particular. Yep.
And Dave Miller going to be with you?
Dave's there the whole way around. And I think really kind of more and more buying into his new role as a broadcaster and not as a racer, you know.
Yeah. Being something of a Germanophile, if that's the right word, you're probably looking forward to the start in Germany
I am hugely. And I think it's going to, in much the same way, I always hesitate to bring other sports into a cycling podcast, but I do remember, my personal background is I spent a few years after I graduated from university in the early 90s, you know, in various states of unemployment, but living and thoroughly enjoying my life in Hamburg, in the north of Germany, and learned to speak German kind of pretty fluently back then, and really fell in love with the country. Then in my professional life, I came back to London eventually, I came back as a football journalist to cover the Football World Cup in 2006 and told all my colleagues, do you know, Germany's going to blow you away. You're going to be completely surprised by what a wonderful, warm, welcoming country it is and how much there is to see and do. And all of them were sceptical and all of them came away from that month thinking, blimey, how come we didn't know? Now, I think the secret's out a little bit now about Germany. Yeah. But I think nonetheless, I think the viewing public are going to be kind of taken by what the Grand Départ looks and smells and feels like in Düsseldorf. And I think it's going to be reminiscent of the Giro when it started in last year in the Netherlands, in the Gelderland. That was amazing. I don't know if you know the scenes of the... I mean, I know we obsess with our own predilection towards packing the streets and watching the bike races, but the Dutch and the Germans will do it in equal measure as well. It's going to be a terrific start. Great send-off.
What else are you looking forward to in this year's tour? Any particular stages you think that are going to stand out?
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because normally you'd go, it'll be Alpe d'Huez or Mont Ventoux, and, you know, actually, normally those stages don't necessarily produce the drama, but they're always the ones you highlight. They're kind of notable by their absence. There are nine, not even questionable, but fairly nailed-on sprinter stages, which is a very large number, actually. Normally, Cavendish looks at this and his ilk, and he goes, ooh, six, maybe seven.
It must be years since there's been nine.
Back to the LeBlanc era, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of tour design. I can't remember one in the Prudhomme era, which has been, let's face it, a decade now. So it's a throwback tour, for better or worse. There's only 36 kilometres, is it, of time trialling, with 13 at the beginning, and the penultimate stage in Marseille is a 23-kilometre time trial. It's very short. None of the iconic summit finishes are there, except for, I think we can now call it iconic, La Planche des Belles Filles, the Plank of the Beautiful Girls, which is the third visit now. And it's only a 5.5K climb off the top of my head. It's quite steep, with that incredibly steep little ramp at the end. But actually, I think that'll produce a really good race, because it's only short.
I often think that the tour designers or the Grand Tour designers slightly overthink the idea that we have, the notion that we have to have all these iconic climbs and these mega stages and stuff like that. The racers make the race, you know. They'll race it no matter what. I think people get a little bit too, you know, maybe overthink it.
I would agree. And my eye, actually, if I'm drawn to anything on this year's, you know, when you look at the route map, apart from the massive transfers, once again, that the whole caravan are going to have to make, but my eye is drawn, actually, to the two stages through the Massif Central, which isn't something we do every year. Normally, the race ducks south of that. You know, you get as fast as you can between the Alps and the Pyrenees or vice versa. This year, we do go into the mountains again. And boy, there are they mountains. You know, we go to Le Puy-en-Velay, places like that. And weather can be a bit questionable there. The terrain's really hard, and maybe they'll produce some of the most unexpected and unpredictable racing. That'd be good, just as legs are getting tired.
Who's going to win then?
Well, rubbish at this, as anyone who's listened to my predictions down the years know. So I'll say this. I don't think Richie Porte will win. I think if you are full out in your attempts to win the Dauphiné and you don't, then it doesn't suggest that you've got it necessarily in your locker to win over 3 weeks with strengthening riders, you know, riding themselves into form alongside you and against you. So once again, I think we're looking at Froome and Quintana. And of the two, I would say, from what I understand, there are serious doubts about Froome's condition within the Team Sky camp, although they'd never admit that publicly. They have been a little concerned. So I would say Mr. Pokerface himself was probably, with hindsight, riding the Giro at three quarters of his capacity, and I think he was actually all about the Tour de France this year, and it suits him. So let's go with Quintana's first ever Tour de France win.
It's interesting you say that about Froome, because I just kind of assumed that after the Dauphiné they'd just kind of go away and go, well, that's fine, we just do a little few tweaks.
Well, you might be right.
And it'll all be good. But well, no, but if that's what you're hearing,
this was ahead of the Dauphiné.
Yeah, right.
This was ahead of the Dauphiné. Now, he didn't win the Dauphiné. He didn't actually come close. But, you know, not for want of trying. It was a bit of an all-or-nothing last stage, wasn't it, to try and recapture that jersey full of panache, much like one of my moves on the track.
Your famous breaks with 10 laps to go.
Well, I just climbed off every time today. But, you know, he's Chris Froome, isn't he? And he does have the huge advantage of having won it three times. But if he does win it, I think... You know, I think it'll go down as his most interesting and perhaps his greatest, because he probably, you know, what he won't do is be the strongest rider in week one, get to the mountains, smash everyone to pieces, gain 2.5 minutes, and then just hang on and get slowly weaker. I don't think he's going to, if he does win, I don't think he'll be like that. So he might have to come from behind and take the jersey in the final week. Who knows? He might take the jersey in Marseille on stage 20, and if he does that, then we'll have a great race, you know. So I think it's beautifully set up, wildly unpredictable. Porte, Quintana, and Froome are the standout candidates. Bardet and Pinot, Fuglsang, Aroux are worthy of note, and so too is Simon Yates. Although, on the evidence of this season, I think it's a year or two too early for him still. And Chavez hasn't raced much. But there's some interesting double-headed teams. Sky's one of them. You know, interesting to see how Geraint Thomas, what role he's accorded. Valverde is, of course, riding for Quintana, but he's Alejandro Valverde. I've forgotten to mention Alberto Contador. And I've forgotten to mention his so-called support rider, Bauke Mollema, who has twice been in second place over the last eight tours, going into the final week of racing. And
yeah,
then just
Mollema's an interesting wild card, isn't he?
He is, he is. Rode a modest Giro d'Italia, and perhaps he's held something back. And I, you know, Contador looks like he might be a bust flush at this point. And watch out for Mollema.
I'm not alone, I'm sure, in thinking, you know, one thing we could really do without is a sort of Froome procession, you know, from week one again. And it sounds, you know, from what you're saying, is that we may not have one.
Don't think we will. Be surprised.
My co-pilot Andy McGrath came up with an interesting stat yesterday. For those who, you know, of a superstitious bent, nobody has ever won the Tour four times. That's not as stupid as it sounds. Obviously, yeah, people have won four and then five,
yeah,
but nobody has won it four times only.
That's completely meaningless, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely pointless. I just wish I'd not said it now, to be honest.
But, I mean, you know, he stands on the... Well, no, he doesn't stand on the brink. He's got 1 foot and half of the other one in history already, Chris Froome. I think it's because his career stops now and he doesn't achieve anything else on the Tour de France. He's already one of the greats.
It is weird, though, isn't it? I spent a bit of time, a few days recently, in Italy with a whole sort of group of international cycling journalists, and I was surprised at the scepticism, the hostility actually that was coming from, you know, people from France, from Spain, from Italy, from Holland, from the Scandinavia about Froome and Sky. I think you can, over here we live in a bit of a bubble in terms of what the rest of the cycling world thinks.
Yeah, undoubtedly true, although I would suggest for anyone with their eyes open, and I'd like to credit the cycling public in this country for having their eyes open, I think that bubble's been, you know, somewhat pricked by Sky's no-needle policy.
Sure.
Or lack of it. You know, I think we're slightly wiser to their truer nature. And what I mean by that is to say it ain't what they were cracked up to be in terms of their anti-doping policy. That's self-evident. And I think it has rubbed people up no end on the continent, because they had a supercilious attitude towards the peloton. There's no doubt about it. They had the bigger budget. They thought everyone was in the dark ages. Everyone was backwards. They had a point to a certain extent. They haven't made friends. They haven't made friends, and they won't be able to make friends in their current guise with their current leadership and their current crop of riders and tactics. But they're pretty good at winning races. Four out of five tours is an astonishing return in this era. And let's face it, I think even their hardest critics of any hue, if they're reasonable about it, would say, you know, if Sky are guilty, in inverted commas, of unethical practice, then we're not comparing like with like when you go roll the years back and think about what was going on 20 years ago. You know, it's a different order of malfeasance, isn't it? It's not the same.
I thought Matt Seaton made an interesting point in his column a couple of issues back, where he said Brits always had this idea that, oh, we don't do that. You know,
yeah,
that's what they do over there. Mm. What's happened in the last few months with British cycling and with Sky is open a lot of people's eyes to actually we shouldn't just blindly trust that everything is in order, you know, question everything.
Yeah, but I mean that's true of wider public discourse and life in every field and every area, you know, ever since 2008 and the banking crisis, and all, you know, cycling's no different. Well, one thing I would say about the peloton and Sky's reputation is I haven't got any hard evidence, this is just anecdotal really, but I would suggest that of the 198 riders minus the nine who turn out for Team Sky, so whatever, the 189 riders who don't ride for Team Sky but start the Tour de France, not many of them wouldn't bite their hands off for a chance for riding for Team Sky. So ask the riders what they think of Team Sky and you might get a very different answer.
The other big event in your year has been your tour, Bikeology.
Yeah.
Tour of theatres. I do remember, probably more than a year or so ago now, you saying to me, yeah, that your agent had decided to book a series of theatres, and you were going to go on and talk about cycling.
Yeah, you almost forgot to ask whether I thought I could do it or not. You know, you can do a one-man comedy show that's 2 hours long about cycling, can't you? And I went, well, I have to now because you booked the theatres. But I didn't really. It was a bit of a mad proposition. some West End producers, you know, basically came up with the idea. They do similar shows with cricket and I think golf and as well. And they kind of thought, well, sooner or later, someone's going to do one about cycling. But I've done a theatre tour now. I have one under my belt. We did 15 shows last year, something like 14, and it went well enough for them to go, right, let's do 25. And this time, let's make the theatres bigger. So we've got kind of 800-seater theatres this time, and final date in the West End, the Lyric Theatre, Shaftesbury Avenue, darling.
You're playing the West End.
I am playing the West End for one night only. It's where I walked past it the other day, and my heart leapt because I've got to stand on stage there. At the moment, Thriller, the Michael Jackson musical, is playing there, and during their downtime, I pop in for one night only. Presumably have to move all sorts of Michael Jackson props off the stage and sort of like make a bit of space for myself.
I hope they're actually going to put the proper billboard up above, you know, even if it is only for one night, because I want to get a shot of that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, there'll be all sorts of photo opportunities.
That peculiar shot with your helmet and the...
Yeah. I quite like that image, actually. There's the poster images of me with a GoPro on my hat. Because a lot of it... So the show roughly divides into sort of like half of it, roughly in content-wise, is kind of Tour de France-y, because I think a lot of people want to talk about that. But half of it is a bit ranty, and there's a bit of kind of my venting a lot of spleen and basically biting the hand that feeds me about kind of like contemporary cycling culture and the way it expresses itself in all its idiosyncrasies in this country. Not all of which is good. Most of which is risible. And we have a lot of fun. At least I have a lot of fun, and the audience sit there with their arms folded going, I can't believe you just said that about Strava. So I try and slay a lot of holy cows.
Have you learned things from the audience as well? I mean, presumably you started off with one thing in your mind, but after 18 dates or whatever it is, you must have...
Fantastic amounts. There's no... You know, telly is... you don't find out until a bit later when you look at Twitter. When you do telly, but you don't have that instant feedback. You know, you're just talking to a lens or talking into a microphone. It's very, very remote feeling, actually. And it's when you get used to telly, you get used to it. And I no longer get nervous when I'm broadcasting on telly. Boy, do I get nervous on stage, though, because the feeling of when a joke doesn't quite work or go down just is the worst feeling. And when something unexpected just hits the mark, it's brilliant. And it takes you off instantly onto a tangent that you never knew there. So I love it. I love the kind of like development. The show is very different from when it starts to 25 dates later. It's added bits, and that's largely down to the audience guiding me really on what works and what doesn't work. You know,
I haven't seen it. I will get along to this tour. I do know that one of the things you do is ask for questions from the audience and pick them out at random. Well, we haven't really got an audience here. We've got a rabble of old blokes who race track, and I did ask them earlier on for some random questions. Shall I choose a few?
Yeah.
Random? Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, this is...
I'm seeing these, by the way. These are hitting me unprepared.
Okay, let's start with this one. I love David Miller on the commentary team, but how many espressos does he have before he goes on set?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think how honestly I can answer this. Espressos aren't the only product of choice on occasion.
They're not the only fruit.
Sometimes he does seem unnecessarily cheerful.
Yeah. And
does it wear off? Does it wear off in the middle? There must be a lull.
Quite funny, actually, because David is, and we both tend towards being soporific occasionally. I'm probably one of our criticisms of our commentary is that sometimes we sound a bit like this. In the middle of a kind of, you know, 110 kilometres to go, and the break is 6:35 up the road, and it's two Frenchmen, you know, and there's no absolute whatever. They're quite... And bear in mind, the Tour de France is going to be broadcast in its entirety this year, with every pedal stroke from the neutralised rollout all to the finish and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. On some of those stages where the peloton is rolling through endless countryside, which looks very similar... I don't envy you your job.
Yeah, although, mad as it sounds, right, if I were watching this at home, I would not be paying any attention to the commentary team at that point. I watch a lot of cycling at home, and I love that stage of a race because I normally just nod off on the couch, to be perfectly honest with you, and just I love the white noise of a bike race going on. I am self-employed. I don't have a place to work. I just love the gentle drift of the commentator talking nonsense, you know, like when it's 85 kilometres still to go, and I kind of wake up at 40 kilometres still.
And some of it is actually just about the event, isn't it? I mean, sometimes I watch, and I don't care who wins the stage. You know, I've been watching the Tour de France on telly probably since something like 86 or whenever, you know, it started on Channel 4.
Yeah.
Always watch it, and half the time I'm just looking at the scenery and just the whole event, you know, the whole spectacle of it.
There is a lot of that. And it's something I've got to pay a bit more attention to. And I think, I think the Tour de France public in particular, the Tour de France public expect that, and they want to hear about the grapes that are planted there and the chateaus that are by the side of the road, and quite rightly so, actually. So I need to develop that side of our commentary a little bit more. That said, even this is one of the great pleasures I have working with David in particular, and I've worked with other co-commentators who are excellent, but David has this kind of supernatural sense of what's going on in a bike race. So when you say there's nothing going on, and Ian, you might say there's not much going on there, and I might feel there's not much going on there. If you're commentating with David Miller, you find out pretty quickly you're wrong. Because even in a kind of classic five-man breakaway with four pro-continental teams and one Cannondale rider, even in that kind of classic breakaway, David spots stuff that you and I would have no clue about, you know? Like, he will be very, very acutely aware of the fact that when that rider, let's say the Cannondale rider, Dylan van Baarle, for example, when he goes to the front, and they look like they're taking equal turns, van Baarle's doing, like, he's doing, like, 40% of...
Soft-tapping.
Yeah, he's soft-tapping. Or he's just moving, you know, and he's... And there's little things that are just there, aware, you know, alive to him that would be honestly invisible to the rest of us. And when you cut up the Moto2 shot of the front of the peloton and the chase being orchestrated ostensibly by Sky, let's say, and Luke Rowney and Stannard on the front, David's not looking at Luke Rowney and Stannard. He's actually looking 15, 16 wheels further back down the line. He's taught me to do that now. That's where the race is happening. And he's looking for all those little nuanced moves as one team starts to get closer to the front and into fourth position and stuff like that. So there is actually all sorts going on, even when there's nothing going on.
To go back to the question, how many espressos does Dave Miller...
At least seven. He's a seven espresso kind of guy.
OK, another question. Race radios, yes or no?
No.
OK.
No, they shouldn't have them, right? They should be banned. Absolutely. Yeah. Why can't we just ban them? Let's just try it. A proper experiment. Just get rid of the damn things. Don't buy the safety argument.
Power meters, yes or no?
Ban them. 100%. Get them off the bikes. Why? So Chris Froome says when that was put to him last year on the tour, he kind of said, "Oh yeah, well yeah," and they might as well just take, you know, give us a single speed bike. Well, no, but power meters, you know, bike technology is one thing. Power meters have definitely changed the way that races are orchestrated, and not for the better.
On the time trial, when they swap bikes, can they? And has anyone thought of using a cast iron bike on the downhills or putting lead weight on?
See a bit of that, don't you, on mountain time trials when they swap bikes? They'll use a conventional road bike on the uphill bit and then they'll switch to a TT bike for the downhill section sometimes. That was a feature of Chris Froome's first win in 2013, I think.
I've read some...
I think it's illegal.
I've read some scientific evidence that suggests that the being heavy on a downhill actually has no advantage whatsoever. Now, anecdotally, I would suggest... That's complete nonsense, because on a downhill, and I'm a good descender, a heavy bloke will just, you know, go past me in exactly the same position.
Right, but who descends better, Nairo Quintana or Thibaut Pinot? Quintana descends brilliantly. You know, Romain Bardet is one of the best in the world. He weighs precious little.
Yeah. So, I'm not convinced there'd be any...
I don't think there would be, no.
Favourite cycling commentator of the last 20 years?
Mine's Ned.
So's mine, obviously.
That's
yeah.
not just because he's.
That's a hard. That's a very hard question, because it's a very small world and we all work together. And I wouldn't like to single anyone out, I'm afraid. But can I just doff my cap to the man I've replaced? Phil Liggett's voice is still for me synonymous with the summer and the Tour de France.
When you first started covering the Tour, what percentage of riders do you now think were not doping? Double negative there in the question, I think.
Crikey, what, in 2003, how many clean riders were there in the 2003 peloton? Flipping heck. Single digits. I don't know if I'm being overly pessimistic there.
I don't know. I'd have gone to 50-50, but I don't know.
50-50, you think?
Sounds a bit optimistic, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's just me.
Could you put a percentage on it now? Would you like to put a percentage on it now?
Yeah, I would. I would say whatever that percentage is that we'll never know, that Ian and I have slightly disagreed on, but let's say it's a minority. Whatever that was, flip it round and reverse it.
And the last one, this is from Roy Page.
Yeah, good old Roy.
Gentleman Roy.
He will always ask a gentle question because he's a gentleman,
yeah.
I hope.
Will there be a new book, says Roy, to accompany the one-man show?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm writing a book about darts at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Lazy git.
Sorry. Not yet, anyway, Roy.
Okay. So, Ruler 17.4.
Yes.
Is in the shops at the moment.
Yes, the big old Tour de France monster special. 21 stages, 21 stories, and a lovely big piece by our German-based team at the front about the German Grand Départ and their general kind of resurrection of cycling's popularity in Germany, which it seems to be, you know, on a nice, pleasantly upward trajectory again.
Can I just ask Neil? What am I calling you, Ian? When you have to, you kind of like have to and probably enjoy doing a Tour de France one every year because it's kind of like the biggest race in the calendar. But is there a bit of you that goes, oh, I've got to do the Tour de France one now because it's such a well-trodden path and Ruler almost specialises or prides itself in digging out the kind of the stories less told and the little niches of cycling. Is it a tough gig?
No, we love doing it. I'm not just saying that. I mean, we've done it in this format for the last 3 years. There's never any sense as like we're treading old ground because yeah. we look at the route and we find a story related to every stage of that route loosely. I mean, some of them we just frankly have to shoehorn in because there's nothing of interest. But you know, what the feedback we've got from people is some of the stories they've enjoyed most have actually been not about cycling. You know,
yeah.
The one that Max Leonard wrote about the Maginot Line
yeah.
is a fascinating little read. And Roger Blachon, the former L'Équipe cartoonist whose cover is on the members issue.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful work.
And
very funny, very funny. His one with Graham O'Brien actually hooked up to a washing machine and his wife standing there telling him to go faster to spin the clothing, I think is just, you know, genius piece of work. So, no, we love it.
Have you had a chance to look through and pick a favourite photograph?
Yeah, I unfortunately nicked Ian's, so he had to think again.
No, that's fine.
I've gone straight for Michael Bland's portrait of Romain Bardet, which is fantastic. Beautifully lit, studied, very carefully composed. Must take him quite a lot of time, I should imagine, to get it. Indoors, he's not wearing lycra. He's wearing a collarless shirt and a jacket. And he looks that combination of immensely fragile and but you know, because you've seen him race, that extraordinary hidden reserves of strength and stamina and strength of will, actually, that Romain Bardet has, and self-belief. And that's all in there for me. And he's a beautiful rider to watch, isn't he? He's just, of the two great French hopes, Pinot and Bardet, I think probably they're both nice guys, really nice guys. But you kind of like instinctively, I think the romantic in us all kind of wants Bardet to be the one who does it.
Absolutely, yeah. He's just a fascinating coach. I mean, Andy and me just sent him a really off-the-wall Q&A with slightly bizarre questions. And I mean, you know, when you have your fantasy dinner party and you come up with Serge Gainsbourg, Javier Dolan, he's a Canadian actor apparently, and Bradley Wiggins over a few pints of beer. Now that's an interesting threesome, but my favourite was the opening one. It was like, what's your karaoke song of choice? To which he came up with Les Lacs du Connemara by Michel Sardou. I will actually put that up on the podcast page so people can hear what a tricky piece of work that is. I mean, hats off to him. If he can pull that off at karaoke, then I've got a whole new level of respect for him.
My commentating compadre, who we talked about, David Miller, does a bit of work with AG2 Le Mondial because he has a connection with their new bike brand that they ride these days. And they have done a bit like FDJ did last year. They've started to take themselves a bit more seriously in terms of time trialing. And Bardet needs to if he's ever going to win the Grand Tour. It's still a weakness of his. So he spent a bit of time in the wind tunnel and outside of the wind tunnel, just on time trial technique with Bardet. And we were commentating on, just the other day on the Dauphiné. And Bardet had another average time trial that basically lost him any chance of actually winning the race. And as soon as he'd finished, you know, he was pinging text messages back to David Miller asking what he thought was good and what he thought was bad. And David just said to him, look, actually, you're going too hard. You're trying to hit a maximum core wattage that you think you can sustain and hold it. And you've got to be, you're not that kind of rider. You need to be someone else. You know, you need to develop a different way of doing it. And you need still to work on your technique. But he does, that will be... Hey, it's a great tour for him. with a limited time trialing, you know, it'll suit him this year.
Ian, after Ned had pinched yours, you chose another one?
Yes, because it was a toss-up for this for me. This is actually, when I say it's my photo, it's about 18 photos. It's Caleb Ewan, shot from the side. I did give a brief to the photographer and said, come back with some Edward Muybridge-esque kind of, you know, I want to see Ewan in full flight, nose on the front wheel, you know, just from start to finish, including the thrust. And it's lovely. I just love watching sprinters do what they do. And that was by Joel Hewitt.
From a commentator's point of view, he's a delight. There is no mistaking Caleb Ewan in a bunch sprint from that head on. Yeah. Well, I say there's no mistaking it. Often there's no seeing him. his lead out man, who's only just signed for Orica, what they call these days, Orica Scott, Roger Kluger, is a track sprinter in his own right. Big German guy, and they've just hit it off as a sort of partnership straight from the desert races in February. And they're going to be a big feature of the Tour de France, those two. And he's vast. I mean, all German sprinters seem to be, but he's massive. And Ewan literally disappears behind him. But he's also very upright, Roger Kluger, so you can pick him out like a lighthouse coming towards you, and then you know that this little figure is just going to shoot out from behind his wheel. Very, very distinctive, and no one does it quite like that. I mean, only Cavendish ever sprinted like that, but even Ewan's position is more extreme.
Is there anybody in a sprint that you struggle to identify because there's just something about their...
There are,
is it maybe down to colour of jersey or just because there's something about them that's not...
Do you know, Tour de France is the easiest sprint to call because it's all the big names and they always win, you know. Nobody ever pulls a real surprise in the Tour de France in a bunch of sprints. It's always one of the big favourites. Who win? Go and commentate the Arctic Race of Norway where everyone brings their kind of... You know, if it's not going to be Christoph, it could be anyone, you know. That's when you really earn your money. But there are entire teams of riders who... There's something about the kit and something about their recruitment policy. They all look identical. They all seem to look identical. Movistar does my head in. If it's not Valverde, who's stubbly and always wears those mirror shades, and it's not Rojas, who always seems to have the national champion's jersey, you know, all those stripes like that, or Valverde does, and it's not Quintana, it could be anyone. And they're called Hernandez and Herrada and Fernandez, and they're just kind of interchangeable. And they all have roughly the same capacity to climb really well. You know, they do my head in.
Can I choose one of Christophe Ramon's photographs of Liège in the article by Morten Okpo about Liège? Have you been to Liège?
I can only hope those pictures weren't paid for by the Liège tourist board.
There is something really nice about those sort of northern French and Belgian towns that are grim, but sort of don't pretend to be anything other than a sort of industrial... town.
No, there's nothing nice about them.
The train station is
the main
very,
square in Liège. The main square in Liège is all right. But
and I said to Morten, who was going to Liège for Liège-Bastogne, I said, again, I knew he would take up the challenge. I said, I do not want another of these pieces telling me how crap Liège is. Yeah. That would be pointless. And he does a good job of ripping apart everybody else's arguments.
I went to Liège-Bastogne-Liège and rode the Sportive version of it a few years ago, and you could understand why people went to Bastogne, but not necessarily why they would come back again. Because it's a lovely part of the world, but Liège is not the...
It's real.
It is real.
Gritty and real.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with that. So all that remains, I think... is the Ruler podcast quiz. The last edition was the Giro edition, and Adam Coatham won the prize there. The next podcast will be along very soon, we hope, in a couple of weeks' time, and it should feature, among other things, an interview with Jeremy Whittle about his new book on Mont Ventoux.
Oh, I've read that.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
really
it's
interesting.
An intense hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
is.
Actually, you know, I've read so many books about the Tour, but actually he does seem to have found, in writing a book about a single mountain, some really interesting stories. All the kind of the stories we know are in there about Simpson and Pantani and Armstrong and Eddie Merckx.
I started it with great trepidation, thinking, it's going to be the same old, and it wasn't. I think he's done a smashing job and really brought it alive. And I just didn't think you could write a whole book about a mountain.
And right towards the end, when he talks to Tom Simpson's daughter, hang on for that chapter, because there's one or two lines in there that will it's gut-wrenching stuff, actually.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's a great book, and you can win a signed copy by answering the following question. When did Mont Ventoux first appear as part of the tour route? Go to the Rouleau website, check out the podcast page. The details on how to enter will be there. That's pretty much it for this edition. Ned Bolting, thanks for joining us. Have a great time in France. You actually have a question for us, I believe.
I do. It's something that's been bothering me for a while. It's just something I've noticed. Given that the Tour de France is starting in Germany, why do no German riders, since Jan Ulrich, have German names like Ulf or Horst?
Olaf.
Or Olaf. That's...
I don't think that's a German,
it's not
name,
a German
is it?
Name.
Olaf Ludwig.
Yeah, okay, all right.
All right, okay.
Yeah,
good.
Thank you. I'll take that one.
Because they're all called John Degenkolb, Marcel Kittel, André Greipel, Emmanuel Buchmann, etc., etc.
Tony.
Et Tony Martin. Nuts, what's going on? Linus Gerdemann, etc.
Linus probably is a German name.
No, it's an American name. Did you never read Peanuts?
Yeah, but wasn't Linus a child of German immigrants?
Whoa.
Can we just stop now?
Okay. Ian Cleverly, thanks for joining us as well. We'll see you for the next one very soon. Enjoy the tour.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.